There is now a lot of discussion because of the policy reality, and the discussion in particular on energy and climate, which is the case for biodiversity, ecosystem management, food security. We see that how really the actors who want to make change, who want really to support sustainable development transitions, are really using the global fora, the global agreements, the global dynamics. That's certainly one big new area of work. I think the second is the new attention. Again, it's not a new issue, the science studies or the science policy discussion. It's not a new issue. It has been studied. There is a lot of academic work on that. But it has taken a new importance because of the role of science in shaping the format and the scope of the policy decision making. Of course, it's quite evident with the climate change controversies. But it's the case on how you measure biodiversity, how you measure natural capital. So there is a whole area of a question where the traditional way to look at science and policy, which was science is making the assessment and then you have the management of the risk by whatever system, institutional system is in place, is now totally blurred. And there is a strong interrelation between science in a way and the scientific community being inclined to take more and more importance in the public and the policy debate, and the policymakers really sometimes using the scientific controversies to even defend their point of view. So there is a new area there. I think we don't have to agree with the tools. It's very interesting how, but again, it is certainly, and everything is around, I think, the role of knowledge in politics. And I think that's really something where a lot of understanding and research should be done. And finally, I would say the traditional discussion around intergovernmental discussion in my field is now much more how the network of actors, the global networks, are really put in place, how they function, what is their vision, how they create coalitions. And that is, I think, an area where, again, there is a lot of work to do. Is there a common vision, how they shape expectations in their own countries, how they work independently from this? And that is related to a new, which is between politics, political science, and international economy, which is, of course, all this role of these global actors in finance, who are taking, of course, a specific role, how finance will finally allow investment in the energy transition, in the biodiversity transition to take place. And I think that linked with this network of actors who made their common representation. So I would say that's a three main view on that.
Excellent. Okay, so maybe to just step back for a second, so that we're all sort of talking about the same time period, I thought we could, that was a little bit comprehensive, but if we step back in time and think first about, imagine we're here at Columbia University in 1976. So you spoke a little bit about the last 10 years, but I want to sort of locate what was the historical trajectory of the frontier before we start talking about what is going on in the future. So if we're here in the 1970s, at that moment in time, what were the most important research questions that were facing people in terms of, you know, applications for sustainable development, and have those questions been successfully answered or not?
The big question was, like, how do we prevent communism? That would be like, how do we sort of organize agrarian reform programs and aid programs so as to prevent Cuba from spreading? And this was like the Alliance for Progress and the Latin America, and so I think this is part of the history of development economics, is like up until 1995 or something was really like it was a Cold War kind of practice, and it was about modernization. It was like this idea that we were going to bootstrap and industrialize these countries, create middle classes, and then the frontiers of growth are unlimited. It's just a matter of getting a bunch of places to look like the U.S. and Britain. And it's not like we solved that problem. Right? So we didn't solve that problem of like where does growth come from, or how do we get modernization? We just sort of decided that we're going to add more constraints to it and make it a harder problem. Like sustainable development, it's like, it's not like we figured out the development problem and so now we can add this constraint of development of sustainability and solve this new harder problem. we didn't solve this first problem of how to develop even unsustainably. And so it's not like, you know, we're adding these more constraints and now we're like going to try to solve this problem. So I have a lot more to say about that. But, okay. let me just give you a reference. Like, so Tony Killick has this book called Development Economics in Action, which is about like how in like 1965 he comes in as like an advisor to Nkrumah in Ghana, and is like, you know, it's coming as part of this modernization project to like help develop Ghana. And they do all this stuff with industrial clusters and all this sort of cutting edge development theory of the time. And, you know, it gets some people some jobs, but it also makes Nkrumah incredibly politically powerful because he's able to target sort of who gets it and who doesn't. And so this was sort of the punchline was that about this was like development economics in action wound up being like used for political kind of things on the ground. And so this is what makes me a perpetual cynic about it.
Well, I guess it's interesting you kind of target the date of the 1970s because I think it's almost very similar to what we experienced in the 1970s at this time because of the energy crisis. Because that's exactly what happened in the 70s in the United States. So before that, I think we had a lot of economic growth. We had a lot of building of power plants, chemical plants, and all, a lot of jobs, and all that happened, and then there was an energy crisis. So we even started thinking about how to make synthetic liquid fuel from coal and all that, but then the price of oil went down very quickly again, so then nobody really cared. So funny thing is that 40 years later, we are stuck with all the power plants and chemical built in the 70s or before that, right? We never really built any new ones because once you build it, you want to run it at least 20 years, and then after that, you just fix it up a little bit, run it a little longer. So we're kind of stuck with our technology which we developed that time, right? But then now all these environmental constraints and other constraints that we have to somehow phase out, people don't want to do it, or the companies. And another big problem is that there's a big generation gap in workers. So whenever I go to conferences, I'm the only female, only the person under the age of usually 55. So they really like me because it's good for diversity, apparently. So I ignore the technology. But once they retire, we really have know-how on, we don't have it anymore, right? How many people know how to build a nuclear power plant, even a coal-fired power plant? It's really hard to see us moving forward without having any knowledge base. But in China, they're building, just talking about even a coal-fired power plant, they build one per week. Their know-how buildup is really fast. So not working with global society will be really phased out very quickly. And not that we can import everything from somewhere else, we still have to sustain within ourselves, use our resources to gain, and that would be the best for the future. But it's getting harder. And another thing I kind of want to add is that it's really nice to, I think I was at the final defense of the first PhD graduate from this program. Yes. I just joined Columbia at the time. I didn't know anything about this program, but more on here at Columbia is really interesting because that entry really here is interdisciplinary in action, not just talking about it, right? Like we are forced to sit together. I've been doing these kind of panels many times. But a lot of schools or a lot of institutions, they don't really actually do that, so then it's really hard to talk. But NSF, National Science Foundation, is really now forcing that in fact, so that some of the SEAS is the, what is it, Science, Engineering, Education, and something like that, the SEAS program, for sustainability program, they really encourage people, you're not allowed to submit a proposal unless you have a as an engineer and scientist, you need to have a social science person on your thing, right? Proposal. So I didn't know what to do. So I was a group, I was submitting a proposal on how to make, what was that one? Oh, bioenergy. How to make hydrogen from food waste in a, like a small refrigerator size unit for the household. And then I had to find somebody. So I Googled everywhere within Columbia and I found a sociology professor. And then we met over coffee at Joe's, right? It's a nice place. And after an hour talk, still have, we have no idea how to talk to each other. It's like, men are from Mars, women are worse than that. So what are you trying to do? So apparently, having a good communication between two fields are still hard. I think over
we come down to the detail of how we can connect between the social science and engineering and science, it's not easy. Without that, you can't really solve the problem, because especially environmental ones, because like we were discussing, there's no economic driver. You have to kind of start with environmental policy. So I think it's great what you guys are trying to do.
Do you mean to add to what you were saying before?
Yeah, the reality in the 70s, and of course, maybe of course the European context was slightly different. Of course, communism issue wasn't that strong and here, certainly. But when I look at the generation of the people who were at that moment in the academia, the 70s was very much environment is something separate, really. And it was very much about how we design policies, the common and control vision versus the integration of the economic instrument. It was really very preliminary. And having environment as a sector where even the academic people didn't communicate, it's very recent now in the economic field that really you have now macroeconomists that really are interested in this question of sustainability or energy or whatever, because it's now the relation with the global picture. So I would characterize the 70s like the entrance of the environment as in different fields as a concern, but with a separate type of academic disciplines and focus. And there was really very little linkages with the development economics, for example, at that moment. Now, of course, everybody's struggling, and I think the picture you're making is really real. Everybody's struggling to try to find the interconnections. It's not easy. Many times, I'm fascinated, for example, with the discussion on climate, where most of the economic discussion would be around how we adjust, we force the system to adjust to emission reductions to price. And that is the main field. And then when you look at the other fields, you see that the question would be much more complex, because there are energy, there are technical issues, you cannot just adjust the system instantly, because life cycle, technology, a number of innovation bases, the system of innovation is different. And that, I think, is very important to try to introduce in the discussion a little more of the capacity of the system to transform, which is a long-term perspective. And it has to integrate some kind of elements of industry, industrial development. And that there is not that culture, certainly. So I agree with you, it's very difficult to scale issues sort of field.
Excellent. So now we've thought about, and one of my other questions, which I'm not going to ask, you guys all addressed very well, is sort of what was the institutional context of successes or failures? It sounds like it was mostly a lot of big questions that were incompletely answered, driven by the political economic conditions of the day. But if we think about what we're facing now, modern global societies, the challenge that we're facing, if you could each state, sort of relatively briefly, but we do have some time, what are the major problems facing your field? And when you're stating some of them, and we can go through this sort of in tiers, I'd love it if you could rank some of the problems in terms of those that are really critical and essential to sort of success in the field, versus those questions that are sort of just bonus, fun, ancillary questions we'd love to have answered. And then you can also discuss some of the questions that are arising today which you might view as trendy or fads that you actually think are somewhat of a distraction because of research. Because I think it's important for people picking research programs to sort of be able to prioritize the different types of research problems out there. So you don't have to list them all at once, but if you have any ideas there. So maybe what are the 2 to 5 most important pressing big research questions in sort of your field, in energy?
Well, in energy, CCS, right? Yeah. So carbon capture and storage is the biggest thing, and there's most funding is there too. So they keep putting more acronyms, so now it says that carbon capture and storage is a CCUS, which started a year ago. It's another fashionable acronym. It's a carbon capture, utilization, and storage. So utilization can be viewed as many different things, but one of the big things DOE being, Department of Energy being put pushing for is converting CO2 to carbon dioxide as a fuel or chemicals. We can do that, so that's one of the ways. You just need to have a lot of carbon-free energy, which we don't have. So we're trying to see what in the future can we just... Best carbon sequestration is not do not take any carbon out of the ground, which is already well stored geologically for years, right? So if you can circulate carbon, but we do need carbon, so circulate carbon above the earth, that's the best way. And if we have, we know those manipulations, we know how to do it, but energetically and for what cost, right? So only way we can do it is if we have an unlimited amount of renewable energy, which is carbon-free, like solar, wind, geothermal, maybe perhaps even nuclear. So if we have that, we can do that. So that's the kind of really futuristic.
But just to be clear, what you're talking about is taking free carbon, using renewable energy to fix the carbon, and then using that like those larger carbon strains, synthetic carbon strains, as the energy carrier.
So, for
just,
example,
not all
yeah.
of us are
okay.
so familiar with this.
So, you know how gasoline is high in energy content, right? So, you oxidize it downwards into CO2, which is low in energy level, so that's why it's not reactive and it stays in the atmosphere for a long time, right? That's why it has greenhouse effect and all of that climate change. So the only way to change, well, if you want to change it, you just need to push it upward to gasoline again or diesel, jet fuel. You can do that. You can make plastics, but you have to push it upwards, right? What do you push up with? That's the question. If you do it with coal, it doesn't make sense, right? Because you're going to emit coal and the CO2 doing that transition. So you need carbon-free energy to push it up, right? So that energy, but that manipulation already scientists and engineers, we know how to. A lot of technology we already know how to do. The scale, the amount of CO2 we have to deal with is so large, that becomes a little issue, but still we can do it. The major issue is for what cost, because we usually run out of environment faster than other things. So that's the one of the areas a lot of people are working on. But I have good faith that we can make it, same as acid rain. You remember when all this story came out, all the companies said, it can be done, right? And electricity costs will shoot up, and nobody can afford the electricity then if we have to control the SO2 emissions, sulfur dioxide. But when the regulation came, they made it, right? It happens. You can do it. But until regulation is there, you can't do it. But one of the challenges with CCS will be most people like to do injection of CO2 underground, but we're talking 150 atmospheric pressure of CO2 injecting into non-porous geological formation. Right? It's not like there's a big room like this open and then we can just put gas into it. So safety, who's going to insure it, who's going to guarantee? A lot of companies not going to last that long to see it, duration of the whole lifetime of the injected CO2. There are a lot of issues with the regulatory. And another thing is we import and export a lot of materials, right? And like when you see in the water back of your coke bottle, you see calories, right? Same as that, every single material, even this one, has carbon footprint, right? So who's responsible for what fraction of the carbon footprint is confusing when you get a lot of materials that you bring yourself on, millions of different types of materials gone in, right? Who's responsible for what fraction of carbon footprint gets really complicated, which I don't really want to work on, but hopefully somebody else might be working on because that's important.
So it sounds like what you're saying is a lot of open questions are, how do we regulate the process the energy generating process and the manufacturing of it all?
I think we can do carbon capture and storage, but at the end of the day, somebody has to do it, right? But unless they're told to do it, they won't do it, because this is not money-making process, it's a money-sinking process, right? It's good for the whole society and government and countries and global communities, so that if you cannot really say, okay, this is your portion versus this is the other person, nobody gonna think it's fair enough for them to jump up and do it, right? They'll do a little bit just to make their company look nice on the surface. But if they think it's fair accounting of carbon, okay, this is how much you should do and this is how much you should do, then I think it's more motivation for them to do it. But without that, it would be hard. And until now, technology-wise, it was one size fits all. Like we've been developing technologies best optimized for cost and conversions and things like that. But then now it becomes you can go backwards is more regional choice, whether it makes sense, because if you're moving these materials over the globe, maybe we can do it more localized. So kind of, we are going down to the smaller scale, more localized selection of what resources they want to use, how they use it. So it's kind of a funny way of existing different scales and how they work with resources.
What are the critical
things? I mean, so my area, I guess, is like, I work on the political economy of institutions, you know, when I think about it in terms of sustainability, so there's not, the intersection of the people that worry about sustainable development and the political economy of institutions is, like, tiny. But there might be, like, the way you can think about it, if you want to think of, like, the formal definition of sustainability in a growth model is, like, the maximum sort of flow of utility you can keep every period holding like wealth constant. And you can, if you're willing to broaden that definition of wealth, so the way the literature has gone, they've broadened that definition of wealth to include like natural stocks and human capital and stuff. But if you can broaden that thing of like what is to be conserved as we deliver a flow of economic well-being to a population, to things like order, the rule of law, the rules of the game, maybe even languages, maybe cultures are also sort of part of the stock of things that need to be sustained over the development path. Then you can sort of start sort of plugging in some of the stuff that these growth theorists and stuff that people worry about into the language of sustainable development. No one's done that, but I don't think that's a big problem. I think that's a small problem. Okay, so so I think the big problem is like, we know that like institutions matter for economic development, but we're really sort of out, once you say that, it's like, duh, and then we're sort of stuck, well, what institutions and how do you get them? One of the things is that, one of the ways of setting up the questions that economists seem to think that good institutions are things that make markets work better. Well, and there's this whole other like literature from development, like structural development, that says it's actually about getting the right markets to break, and like that you need to get the prices wrong in some systematic ways, away from their market values, in order to get sort of the kinds of externalities that lead to economic growth. And trying to figure out, I think, to what extent getting prices right in the sense of reducing dispersions of prices and getting, so for example, think of microfinance as a version of this. So the microfinance is really about sort of overcoming the market failures in credit markets by sort of harnessing local information. But there can be another vision of this, which is actually like, maybe it's really important that not that you get that you overcome the information problems in the credit market, but it's in fact that you leverage those information problems and get credit to like these kinds of industrial clusters that are going to bootstrap themselves into starting up a manufacturing sector. And so that in fact you want to like, you know, keep some firms out of the credit market in order to target credit to particular sectors that have sort of substantial externalities. So I think that's sort of this thing where like a lot of the literature in growth is about measuring TFP as deviations from perfect markets, but then there's this other world that thinks about agglomerations and externalities as the sources of TFP, and how do we reconcile sort of these two visions of like where does growth sort of come from? So what are the, do good institutions look more like aerodivergent competitive markets, or do they look less like them? And then so I think we don't, and that actually speaks to like, when you know the answer to that question, like a lot of other questions kind of drop, like you can start talking like industrial policy becomes like, you know, that's a thing you can do if the market doesn't already do it. So it becomes like, you start targeting sectors and firms and things with policy that you can't necessarily, that while the other vision of development is like, you let the state just fix market failures and then let the market sort of pick what firms and sectors thrive. I think the other thing is that, we don't have yet, and it's happening slowly, is like this integration of behavioral economics and political economy, where you're starting to think about that maybe personality foibles and things that make, you know, that human behavioral foibles don't just affect, like there's a large literature now looking at how they show up in markets, and there's even a large literature showing how it shows up in voting, but not yet like a literature looking at, say, bureaucrats or regulators or politicians and how very sort of systematic behavioral failures can actually sort of be amplified or mitigated by the right political institutions. So that, in some sense, we get political institutions to do things that we, like, you can argue, one argument for why we do redistribution by the state is because even though we're all privately altruistic, we sort of change our minds sometimes. And so we don't credibly always give to the person on the street. And so one of the things you can argue is that we use the government as a commitment device to do that redistribution so that we don't have to trust ourselves. And so thinking about how government, how like political institutions and stuff interact with behavioral economics is sort of one thing that's open. I think there's also what's sort of starting is kind of an integration of anthropology and so you can argue that it's like economics has gone over and taken over political science. where I think there's going to be like the sort of interesting melding is like this intersection of I think so. The thing I like want to make my PhD students read is like lots of history and lots of anthropology, because those are the things that are repositories of knowledge that economists, which is where I come from, just wouldn't have access to with their tools. Like they don't hang out in small scale societies for 10 years learning how they work. And they don't hang around in archives for 7 years learning how like things work. So there's no kind of no substitute for that kind of knowledge. There's no data set you can download and just start running regressions on that replicates that kind of knowledge. And so that's sort of the thing that like we need to figure. And one of the things sustainable development could be the place to figure that out is how do you integrate those kinds of like those kinds of epistemologies with sort of the tools that. That you know we're all trained in. Yeah, it's fine. I'll wait there. Oh, actually, let me just say. one is actually going back to like something that was said about the philosophy of science. I think there's this other thing about making the production of knowledge part of the equilibrium and like studying how the production of knowledge and it's what ideas stick and what ideas don't stick, and doing that with data and like with identification strategies. And so there's a lot of stuff around like data mining and sort of text analysis that I think lead us to start looking at this, but I think sort of thinking about the production of science itself is something that can be studied and that has scientists have incentives. And we should look at the production of knowledge also as something to say. Yes.
In addition, I think of course one of the main problems of the international political economy on these sustainability issues is the problem of collective action. Of course, obviously it still is. How we get countries, actors act together, how to eliminate the scenario problem. So it's very sort of, long-standing problem which is still there. So, but certainly there is a new question on, again, taking knowledge as a way to transform the process of negotiation. So one aspect is we should never, when you look at most of the modeling of collective action, the results would be there is no possibility of cooperation, or very little. In fact, the vision of the necessity to cooperate is transforming itself into knowledge. And that's, I think, on collective action, one of the things which would be interesting to factor in, how to create knowledge, how this knowledge is transforming the vision, the expectation, the vision of the interest, for example, which is far from being static. When I look to the all the discussion around climate and the developing countries' involvement, the change in China vision of its own interest around climate comes from this introduction of knowledge in the process of negotiation, but in the process of the policy making itself. So I think there is really an interesting area. How the scientific, what all the type of knowledge come in to transform the vision of the expectation, the vision of the interests, and how they can be modified, and that allowing for collective action. I think the second aspect, which I think in a way Suresh referred to, is we need more about understanding the strategic, yes, in a way, a strategy for growth, which is the sustainability is a normative vision. Of course, it's really why we would like to really preserve natural capital, we would like to have a certain vision of the transition. So it has, at least a target day, it has a view on the finality of the objectives. And that's where I think the discussion about industrial economics targeting to the actors that want to change or have an interest or a vision or see their benefit in their own behavior to change is I think certainly something interesting. And in political science, you could say that the classical political and economic view will try to understand the power relationship, and then you could look at differently at how, in a way, what kind of institution, system, incentive, structure can support the actors who have this vision to change the vision of the state. And it can be very practical, the new energy sector, for example, really tackling this. That's very similar to tackling the sector. Can we produce external political externalities that we also do not do? Is that only corrective action that we do not produce? And finally, maybe it's another area where I think we have a lot to think is about this notion of sovereignty and how the country, the nation state level versus the different global actors, and how this vision of what where the democracies or system, political system define the interest and how the interest is defined, and where sustainability can be incorporated in the discussion of the policy consequences. And that's where sovereignty as a capacity to control can be transformed as a different vision, where sustainability is really the positive outcome for governments to produce for their own consequences. And that's very much about the social representation in the countries of the future of development, which is some not, of course, totally on the individual behavior or mindless or consciousness, but the collective representation of what is benefiting the society and what is the type of development a society would look for, would ask for. And that is very much about this social representation, where I think a lot of new work can be done.
Okay, so now you've done 30 years of research, and it's 24. Okay, we're back here, and we're looking back. So this is like 6 presidential elections from now. From what you understand about how the world works, how research is progressing, what does the world look like? What are the challenges that people 28 years ago in 2012 thought we were going to solve, but then failed to solve? And which ones were the ones to be successful? And where is it that, you know, a PhD student in 2012 did a dissertation that had a huge impact on the world today in 2012?
30 years.
30 years. 30 years.
Well, people say the research problem is exactly similar projects. Similar professors, and then we'll be old enough to say, oh, 30 years ago, we've been doing that. So it feels like there's, I don't know, maybe political economic cycle of the
trick is to live long enough.
To still be relevant.
Well, as a young person in the field, I hear that from senior members all the time. So I'm optimistic that it will be a lot, it will be incremental advancement, hopefully game changer. That's what we're hoping for. But we'll see. You have to work really hard for next 30 years for sure. I think it'll be similar issues because the US, our population is, you know, not like we are in the exponential growth still, and it will be like the next few decades for sure. That I don't think will change in global community as much compared to individual countries. Will change a lot. So a lot of countries has a stabilized population that makes big impact. So I know my colleague, I teach a course, freshman course called A Better Planet by Design with Professor Lar, which is an interesting course. You do like it. I teach the part on energy, teach the part in water, two important things, and for the future of future of humanity. And it's really nice to teach it together because you can't have energy without water, you cannot have clean water without energy, so it goes hand in hand, right? So we try to introduce all of those together, but first class he always says, well, you know, if you really want to solve all the environmental and energy and water issues, we just need to get rid of the water.
People have been saying that for centuries.
Yeah. So how you do it is important, I guess. I guess if you stabilize the population. And in fact, when I went to China last December, they said they need to get a lot of carbon credit. They're like looking at the, oh, by the way, they were so proud that now they're the number one emitter of CO2. Anything number one they like, I guess. To get a lot of carbon credit because they did the one-child policy for so many years, that should be that. Which, you know, it could be true, right? If they didn't have done that, I'm sure we have a lot severe environmental issues now. So here's the sub-truth to it.
Okay. So necessarily, research is like the stock market. It has to follow a random walk, because if you knew what the best prediction was, you'd be doing it. And so there's got to be like the excess that you can actually tell people to go after. It's got to be like, it's got to be, you know, there can't be that much there, because otherwise you'd be doing it. So I think it's like that, so that you, lots of things can change, right? Like, so the thing that set the post-war research agenda was World War II. And just like, so people in, you know, the problematic sort of laid out by why did we go into World War II just traumatized the Western world and like set sort of what social science research looked like for a generation. If something like that happens again, that'll set research on thinking about those kinds of questions again. So I think there's like, I think it's the idea is that social science at least will respond to the things that happen in society, and so that will, so what happens in the world will actually sort of be determining of what sort of research will be considered really, really relevant. So for example, right, just thinking what the financial crisis has done to economics, that it hasn't done yet, but I think the cracks are there, and that like essentially there's going to be a new macroeconomics coming out of this that's going to be and it's not yet born, and we don't know what its ingredients are going to be, but there's definitely like a lot of people, sort of graduate students now, that are just incredibly talented, thinking about what are the like how to both not throw away what was good about the old macroeconomics, but how to bring in all the stuff that was new. So that I think what we do in macroeconomics will be very different from what we do now. Yeah, I'd like to think that we'll come to like that in my dream world there doesn't exist economics anymore. There's just like social science, and that we just do it. And it's like, and that so that all of these sort of silos that are set up across these disciplines just don't kind of exist, and everybody's like fairly conversant in each other's methods, and we just kind of are like get on with the business of doing kind of just social science. And so at least I think the trend on interdisciplinarity is just going to kind of grow, because from the perspective of any university administrator or grant administrator, they're like, they read these grant applications and stuff, and they're like, these guys are studying the same thing, and so why are we like sort of, you know, do we have all these people sort of siloed off from each other not talking? So I think that sort of thing is going to
when we do scenario planning for 40 years ahead in our own country, we actually have six axes, sometimes it's four, that we go by. So some of those sorts of things are as out there as Gaia principles. The next one might be privatisation of everything. The next one might be human rights resources. It used to be just human, you know, water as a human right, but now it's human rights to all resources. But we talk about new economy, effectiveness and services, meaning totally change the product whatsoever. if you only have a benefit and the product that we might have been making 40 years ago isn't necessarily the way that we make it in the future, and efficient services. So with those sorts of axes, I can see a lot of research, but you have only touched two of those.
But I don't think those are the right axes, honestly. It's like,
how do you do scenario planning without those sorts of...
I think the axes for research are actually going to be way more general and abstract than actually those particular six. So,
what could be more abstract than Gaia?
I'll just offer one more, which is
okay.
That I think like the economy is going to be global in a way that it has. It's going to look more global, like 19th century global, than global 20th century global. In the sense that the labor market integration is just going to proceed at pace, and it's going to happen through online labor markets and through just gross flows of people. And when you have people working with each other across borders and stuff, that generates that generates social configurations we can't really anticipate in a way that just integrating product markets and capital markets won't. Like integrating labor markets where you actually have to like regularly interact with people, that's like a kind of a level of globalization that looks much more like the 19th century mass exodus out of Europe into the new world than it looked like the latter part of the 20th century where it was integrating products and capital markets.
If you really want to answer this, we're sort of running out of time. Okay, so we can have the one last question I wanted to just get you guys to state publicly just for everyone is sort of current students, right? What are the methodological tools that you think people really need to be successful over the next decade? And when you see graduate students, one of the big educational gaps they have, just because that's something that's immediately relevant.
Computer programming. That's it. It's it's just like everybody in every discipline needs to know how to like, it's like speaking a foreign language. You need to speak a foreign language and like know how to program a computer. And these are just like kind of, like in real programming, like
can we substitute those?
Sorry. So you're under training. Sorry, Sol.
And you have much more culture and social science and philosophy is a metrics for that, of course. Second is really to be much stronger in empirical analysis, that really do empirical analysis with different methods is super important, because then you can make the bridge and with whatever action should be implemented in the future. So, and I do see that this is something like that. I want to say this too.
Excellent. So, how old is it here still here?
Yes.
So I'll let you cut us off, but until you do.
Well, as long as people have questions.
Have any questions they want to have.
One of the driving forces that I see in new research is this evolving field of complex systems and complexity. Do you see that as something that is affecting a sea change or other changes in your fields, and where do you see that going?
So I've been around this for a while, the complex system stuff, and I think it's going to, if it was going to have an impact, it might have already, it might actually show up in macro, in this macroeconomic thing I've been talking about, but I think it's not going to be the paradigm shift that its proponents are. It's going to be another thing in the toolkit. It's like regression discontinuity. It's going to be like another thing that you know how to answer a particular question, and it's going to be another tool in your toolkit, but it's not going to be like, I think, a paradigm shift. Like
well, complexity in technology development has been always there, right? So it's not something new, but I think we're trying to make it simple. That's what we do, how to simplify the question to the point that we can answer it. That's what we do as a career. So I think we are pretty in tune with that, but I think going back to the question you asked, next 30 years will be in order to develop any technology to be commercially implemented, from the thinking about the new technology, it takes about 20 years. It takes really long time to make something really happen in real life from the day you conceive that idea. So I think it's hard, but there's a new thing came into our lives, like the same as when steam engine made our lives drastically. It was game changing, right? The new thing is automation. Until now, we really didn't have automation that we had to depend on people to do a lot of things, right? But with the new automation, it's really to the point that we can make everything, a lot of things robotic, that we can kind of eliminate a lot of uncertainties or complexities because we can do a lot with less errors or more consistency. So I think that will make a big change, because in the past, for example, power plants are designed to be large, because you cannot sell a small power plant plus a person to operate it to each household, right? That doesn't make sense. But now, if you can fully automate it, you can actually have energy consumer to become an energy producer, like the same as you buy a car and you drive it, because it's automated enough. So those kinds of things will make a big change in technology development, same as you're the operator of your iPhone, right? You operate a lot of things nowadays. So training the customer would be important, and make it automated so that anybody can use would be very nice. So complexity will be built in, but fully automated.
Yeah,
I would pick up on a couple of things that Dr. Naidu and Dr. Tubiana said. You mentioned things that you sustain, like law and order and stuff like that. And I think about endogeneity problems there. I mean, perhaps law and order and inclusion in these things affect our ability to sustain law and order and inclusion and things like that. And you also highlighted the role of collective action, which obviously hasn't been perfectly solved, and I don't know if it's ever been perfectly solved, if that's possible. And then you said again that research, you use the example of World War II, it tends to follow things that hit really hard. If we don't, and you of course brought us to think about 2040 and what are we looking at in 2040, if we continue, as we've been continuing, climate change will be the World War II in 30 years that everybody will be thinking about all the time, as the thing we didn't prevent, that how do we prevent the next one. It makes me think, what are the inputs to a society, a social system, a global social system that could perhaps have prevented climate change, and what that's the biggest picture question I can think of is how, what we need to be different in order for us to do the things that we technologically can do, but for whatever, for various reasons, haven't done.
Yeah, that's
kind of
easy. You
get
the answer.
Well, sure, right, exactly. but I mean, like, that's, I don't know, that's, if you follow the framework of research follows things that failed, maybe that's where research will be, and I have no idea, you know, nobody knows what those things are, but, you know.
But just to react very, very quickly to your, it's certain that the framework we used, even to try to agree with different countries together, for the moment, my evaluation is that has prevented that we could agree and make change. And basically because we did have, and that was of course all the discussion around the cost of the damage of climate change and their evaluation. But we, with the instrument we have in place, we cannot envisage change if not at an enormous cost. So we cannot just understand what it could be because of the tools we have. So anything, when you look at the most of the economic models on the emission reduction, you see that before the system to reduce emission, you have to do growth, you have to do the job, and it is an enormous cost to the economy. Because of the modeling, not because we know exactly what will happen with the different sectors. So I do think that the research has an enormous importance to foster or to prevent change. Then the perspective that the policymakers have is really drafted and really shaped by this, the representation of the economy. And I do think there is in the economy modeling and the linkage between the macro and the sectoral analysis really a gap there. And if we cannot bridge the gap, it's very difficult to have a view. Of how the change is possible, what would be the cost, are they vulnerable or not? And I think we have a very distorted vision for the world.
I think we can do one more quick one, and then we should get back to our lesson.
I'll let you guys do the sending bid auction for the social science working together with no boundaries. However, if you want to take the current status, we see, for example, in economics, that although there are a lot of interesting influences from behavioral economics, anthropology, history, trying to influence the way even tools work, or we think about actions or behavioral changes, everybody knows, you know, Shrogan, many others. I find a bit difficult to see. So there are very interesting progress. The application of this within a system that sometimes still thinks with archaic assumptions, meaning that we can continue to consume and produce at this kind of rate. So I'm referring also to something that Professor Sachs highlighted this morning, the transition towards a low carbon economy. We can actually do that, assuming that the right economic instruments and willingness. But still, the problem of consuming sustainably resources, I fear, is still there. So, I'm not actually suggesting going to the concept of degrowth, like not to ensure that are sustained, because it would be a bit difficult. But my question is there any conceptual framework or paradigm shift that you see reachable in future years? Because that's what I thought I think we need to try to achieve. Kind of complicated, given the right assumptions, you know, that make an economics or even another discipline.
So I'll just quickly defend economics. What economics says that we're going to get perpetual growth in is growth in utility. And the actual resources used to give that can be devastating for the environment or have nothing to do with the environment, as long as they can. Literally, all of our neoclassical growth models, that's what they're about, is like a flow of utility, not necessarily a flow of things. And so the relationship between perpetual growth of an economy, which is about things that, you know, give about things that we value, and actual natural resources can be really tight, which is it right now, but it doesn't have to be really tight. And you can imagine a totally different set of commodities that give people utility that we buy and sell that have nothing to do, that are very, very low impact, but we still have lots of economic growth.
Well, I guess technology side, you have to make it cheaper and technology for people to choose. At the end of the day, you choose what energy you want to use, right? You can always pay a little more to Edison to buy wind power, right? I mean, if you level the playing field a little bit, it becomes the people's choice. And energy and water is very emotional things to people because it's really close to whether they can live the level they want it to be or not, right? So as scientists and engineers, we're trying very hard to level the playing field by using maybe switching the fuels or resources, give more options than just saying, dictating to the public that this is the only way, this is the best way, you should just use this. I think future should be we create all these different options and hopefully both market and public with good conscience decide the right sustainable pathway to go there. That's what I'm hoping.
Well, I think there's a lot of possibility in the way we value things. It's not just an immediate judgment every day. So really the social preferences, the collective preferences, I think are an issue where we should think more about how they can be shaped and how they can change. And that is the response to the content of what could be economic growth or what could be growth. Not in physical terms, but of course on the value and the utilities. But I do think we need a reflection on that. I think we are still very far away from understanding how these collective preferences may be modified or can change and what is what drivers. And I would think that it is an enormously important thing.
All right. Thank you very much. If you'd like to join me.